From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Writer Bruce Feiler feared he and his wife were breaking under the pressures of work and raising young twin daughters. He looked for advice from his parents, from friends, from books. The search turned into something much bigger. He went to business gurus, experts on Middle East peace negotiation, sports coaches, the U.S. military. Now he's sharing what he's learned this hour on Point, advice for creating a happy family. You can join the conversation. Do you need it? Could you use it? Or is it all easy street at your house? Do you have the secret formula? A secret formula. Let us hear it. Joining me now in the studio is Bruce Feiler. He writes a column about contemporary families for the New York Times. He's author of Walking the Bible and The Council of Dads. His new book is The Secrets of Happy Families. Improve your mornings, rethink family dinner, fight smarter, go out and play, and much more. Bruce Feiler, welcome. It's great to have you right here.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be with you.
I guess there's no avoiding starting with Tolstoy. Of course, you do. Tolstoy, all happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And you used to be skeptical about old Leo's observation.
Yeah, well, my reaction when I first read that, and this is a technical term, but I thought it was idiotic. Right? Of course, all happy families are not alike. Some are big, some are small, some are boisterous, some are quiet. But what's happened is in the last few years, there has been this breakthrough, this explosion of knowledge about how families function, about dinner time, discipline, difficult conversations, all of the day-to-day activities of life. And really, for the first time since Tolstoy wrote that over a century and a half ago, we have the knowledge to actually address his point. And is it possible that he's right? I say the answer is yes.
Hey,
I think it's all out there.
Is it possible that there can be an explosion of insight about families in the year, 2010 or 11 or 12 or 13? I mean, families have been around by definition forever. How can we have an explosion of new insight now?
Well, let's look at positive psychology. We know that in the first century after Freud, that psychology mostly looked at people who were dysfunctional in one way or another. And it was the birth of the positive psychology movement a decade ago that said, wait a minute, let's look at people who are functioning and what can we learn from them.
Okay.
The same thing is now underway with families. That most of the study of families in the century that there has been psychology has looked at families that have broken down. Now, for the first time, there is concentrated effort on can we identify skills that allow people to bounce back from setbacks? Can we identify certain patterns? Can we isolate when are the difficult spots and figure out how we can work through them? So the answer is yes. For the first time in academia, we're actually looking at this.
We'll look at where you turned to harvest some of those new insights.
Yes.
But first, remind us of why. What was going on under your roof, in your family, in your house that made you say, whoa, I need some extra help here?
Well, as you alluded to at the top of our conversation, I have a working wife. I have identical twin daughters. At the time, they had just gotten through this slog of sippy cups and diaper caddies, right?
Yes, when I know it well.
Exactly. How many kids do you have?
Three.
Exactly. So in that period, you're always on the defense and you don't play offense. And I felt, okay, now we can turn to offense,
mm-hmm.
right?
We've got a little space to breathe. Let's figure this out.
You know, we talk a lot about the racing the biological clock to have our kids,
mm-hmm.
but there's another biological clock before they leave the house. When there's this
right.
kind of window.
Don't screw it up all the way through.
Exactly. You have this window of opportunity when you can build a family culture, when you can teach values, when you can make those connections. And I was ready to do that. And there was nothing there. There was no advice. And
how can that be? Go to the bookstore or Amazon.com and you've got book after book on families and family life.
Most of it focuses either on those early years, right? Napping, breastfeeding,
mm-hmm.
Body training. There's a lot on teenagers. Actually, in this kind of golden years of childhood, there's not a lot. And even more, there's this straitjacket that parents are in that the only ideas we're allowed to implement must come from this family improvement industry, from shrinks or self-help gurus or other experts. And again, you've mentioned it several times here. In every other area of contemporary life, there's all this research about how to make groups and teams work effectively. I wanted to go to those folks. What are you doing? What are you taking from your world and trying with your own kids and bringing it? And I want to bring those ideas.
Like who? Who'd you turn to? If it wasn't family therapy outfits or the family industry, as you say, where'd you turn?
Well, I turn to business, for example, and to Silicon Valley, right? What is one of the chief problems that families have? And that is life is constantly changing, right? Just when kids stop teething, they start tantrums. Just when they stop needing our help with a bath, they need our help dealing with cyber stalking. The great Salvador Minuchin from Harvard said that families have to be adaptable. Well, how do you do that? Turns out there's a tremendous amount of know-how going on right now in business, which is that you have to be able to adapt and change in real time. And I went and looked at all these families, and we have adopted a system now that a lot of these families are doing, which is based on this idea of agile, right? We're going to respond all the time.
Corporation is going to be the agile family?
Exactly.
I can see people like listening, paying attention, saying,
yes.
Oh, maybe, but at the same time, we're going to run it like a business with everything we see in business? I don't know.
We're not going to have a CEO. We're not gonna do it that way.
Yep.
But what we're gonna do is we're gonna say how we're gonna do it. Let's just talk about Agile, for example. We now have a weekly family meeting.
Mm-hmm.
It takes 15 to 20 minutes. We ask three questions. What worked well this week? What didn't work well? What will we work on in the week ahead? And
are your kids putting up with this? They're not like jumping out of their, I don't know, they're not jumping out the windows?
They love it because, first of all, they get input. We actually have them participate with our supervision in picking their own rewards and punishments, because the latest research, Tom, it shows that kids who set their own schedules, make their own work plans, evaluate their own progress, it's building up their brains, giving them the skills they're going to need later in life. You can't just get your kids to 16 and say, go forth and make decisions. You got to give them practice.
Okay, so there's family management. We'll look at that. I also spotted a column, an essay you put together on family stories as very important to family stability, family health, and ultimately to individual health. What do you mean by that?
This is the single most interesting idea in The Secrets of Happy Families, and it has to do with knowing your family history. Researchers at Emory gave kids a do-you-know test. Do you know where your grandparents were born? Your parents went to high school? An aunt who had an illness that she overcame? Kids who know more about their family history had a higher sense of self-esteem and a greater sense that they could control their own lives. It was the single biggest predictor of a child's emotional well-being. And as the researcher told me, it's the kids who know they're part of something larger than themselves. So you want to spend time talking about your family's positive moments, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But even more, your family's negative moments. Because when kids hit their inevitable hurdles, this will give them the confidence, oh, my aunt got through it. Oh, my uncle got through it. There are three types of family narratives.
Mm-hmm.
Ascending, we had nothing. We worked hard. We had it all.
Yep.
Descending, we had a lot. There was a storm, a hurricane, a recession.
Mm-hmm.
We lost it all. Or an oscillating narrative. The kids who understand, oh, we had some ups, but then my grandfather lost a job.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we worked hard and my mother was on the local board of the hospital, but then my uncle got sick. The kids who understand that they have an oscillating family narrative understand that there are going to be bumps in their road. And it's not a crisis. I mean, as you know, with young children, when it gets hard,
mm-hmm.
they want to quit. And what's the golden ticket for parents? Kids who are intrinsically motivated and who push through, who have grit. All right, that's the trendy word now,
mm-hmm,
grit.
Sure.
This shows them, guess what? In your family, we've had grit. That will give them the sense that, this is in my lineage. I can make it happen myself.
And, of course, every family, one way or another, has that oscillating pattern in its fortunes over time. Every family. No family is all up or all down. But not every family shares that, implants that, shares it with the kids?
Exactly. And I have to say for myself as a parent, this has allowed me to be much more open about my own difficulties. We play a simple game that I played growing up called Bad and Good at dinner. Some people play Roses and Thorns or Highs and Lows. And the part of it is letting the children see the parents struggle. Right? And being much more open. One of my daughters is something of a perfectionist, and we're saying, okay, we want to see you try and fail, and we want to reward
that.
Exactly. And so, yes, I have been flooded with calls from people saying, this has allowed us to bring that alcoholic uncle or that difficult situation out into the open.
I think it's
kids.
Great to talk family history. Absolutely great and important for kids. But you say family dinner, not necessarily. Once a week at your house now? Is that what I remember you coming out of this with?
Well, family dinner is fantastic. If you can do it, it's wonderful. But a third of us are not doing it. Americans are 33 out of 35 countries. The key thing about family dinner is Nothing has been more studied than family dinner. There's only 10 minutes of conversation.
10 minutes can be a lot. But if there's nothing else, if that's the only 10 minutes, that's a big deal.
It's fantastic. I mean,
but the you're rest, saying don't worry about
the
it.
The rest is taken up with take your elbows off the table and pass the ketchup. Yeah. What I'm saying is you can take that 10 minutes and put it to any time of day. So if you can have family dinner, great. But my wife works late. So family breakfast. Meet for a bedtime snack at 8:30. What you talk about is more important than what you eat. It's that bonding time that makes the connection. So when you're pushing your kid to get out the door, do their homework, or practice their piano, or go out and throw your baseball more, you have that connection. So when you're pushing them, they know you're doing it from a position of strength.
There's history to be told and shared here. There's dinner to be had or not had. Do it the way you like. There's maybe lessons from the military, from negotiators, from business. Bruce Feiler says, have a family mission statement in his new book, The Secrets of Happy Families. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with Rodney Atkins and family. We'll be right back.
Grandpa was here and she knew how proud he'd be and how much he'd love to see a few new babies, the same old crazies. I've known them my whole life and they still amaze me. Don't get to choose them, but you hate to lose them. You gotta love them, 'cause they're your family.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about family life, the real modern family, and how to make it better. One man's effort to figure it out, to find a better way. Bruce Feiler is with me in the studio today. His new book is The Secrets of Happy Families. Improve your mornings, rethink family dinner, fight smarter, go out and play, and much more. Bruce, we got a lot of response from people here already online. John says, happy kids, tell them you're happy to see them each morning. Maybe simple as that, maybe not. Jim says, secret to family happiness, ice cream. That does have some tradition, some history.
Grandparent.
Grandparent. Chris says, we forgave each other for all our sins. That can be a tall order, but hey, great if you can pull it off. Morgan, you know, make your family a kind of a special place. She says the secret is being able to shut out the real world and genuinely fully breathe in the real world. Your family, make dedicated time with the family's the focus and be silly with each other. Jalapeno Swartz says never bring up the past. So I don't know how that goes with family history. Salome, this is an interesting one, says you need one person focused on managing and assisting in everyone's happiness. It's near impossible with two working parents. What about this in your household? I mean, I note that you're a guy who's gone out to try and figure this out with your wife, who, from what I'm hearing, works some pretty long hours. Is this, you know, in many families, by hook or by crook, it's the woman who sort of is the ultimate backstop on making sure that it hangs together. Have you gone out and asked the business rule because you're a guy and you're just not willing to be the one? Are you taking more care of the family than your wife? And you've got to have a different system because you won't backstop at all or don't?
Two big changes have gone on in the family in the last generation. One is that women have been flooding into the workplace, as we all know. 2/3 of women now work outside of the home. But there's another big change, which is the dads have come flooding into the parenting space. And dads are much more involved than they ever were in the past. And I think that one of the reasons you're seeing the kinds of changes that I'm documenting in The Secrets of Happy Families is that the sacred divide between work and family no longer exists, okay? So on the workers can check in with their colleagues at night, but also parents can check in with their kids during the day. And I think this new generation of parents is saying, we want solutions. We want things that work. So this debate, be strict like the Chinese, be lax like the French. There's a kind of impatience out there. Tell me what works, and I want to do it. And I think that these people are taking new ideas wherever they come from. So let's just talk about this mission statement. You've mentioned, mm-hmm. You've teased it a couple of times.
Well, I'm no doubt many listeners. I've been at many corporate retreats over the years where mission statements have been written. It can be pretty grim going. I mean, yes, it's important to think about what you're really there to do, but we know that, oh no, not another mission statement session. What does that really mean in a family?
I talked to Jim Collins. He's the author of Good to Great, the defining management book of the last decade. And Jim said that successful human organizations, companies, nations, religions, families, they do two things. They preserve the core. They stimulate progress. This idea of a weekly meeting that I was talking about is very good for stimulating progress because you can change in real time. You try something this week. Next week, it's going to be different. Mom's got a business trip. The week after, Junior's got a sports event. You can change. But what about preserving this core? And so he recommended that we do this mission statement. At first, I thought it was cold, maybe even corny. I'm a little corny, so I was okay. I could get over that.
We're all right with corny if it's important.
And then someone said to me, "Can your kids identify what values are really important to you?" And I thought, maybe, but they'd kind of have to guess. I've actually never told them. So we did the family equivalent of a corporate retreat. We had a pajama party. We piled into the bed, and we had the most amazing conversation, Tom. What's important to us? When someone comes to our house, what do you like to show them? When we're not together, what do you miss? And we went through not 30 values, five values, eight values, 10. Like honesty is the best policy. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. I believe that, but is that really a core value? No, it's not. It didn't make the list. So we came up with this list. We are travelers, not tourists. We like to travel. We help others to fly. We don't like dilemmas. We like solutions. It's a favorite line of my wife's. The research shows—
So these aren't fundamental things like be honest, be compassionate.
It's not. No, it's not something. Jim said to me—
Because I was wondering, I thought, I mean, you say, do your kids know what values are important to you? I would think that your kids would know that just by living with you for some time.
But that's the point. That's what we're talking about here. This is what this entire conversation is about.
Yeah.
We have our jobs. We work on those. We have our hobbies. We work on those. We have our bodies,
but
Tom.
If you're not demonstrating through the way you live, every day, every month, every year, what matters to you, something's off the rails.
This gets to the crux. We have this – our families just are. We have this idea that family is organic, that we're somehow just supposed to know. But the truth is in no other area of our lives, we simply do not work on our families. We just expect them to be. And a lot of what I'm talking
about here – Isn't that because traditionally we had – the families are where you had the most face time. It's where you had time together, maybe with two working parents. You don't have it anymore. But, you know, traditionally through living with one another, living out your values, and maybe, I don't know, maybe on top of that, maybe church or temple or you know, whatever your religious envelope was, if it was important in your family, wouldn't those, you know, modeling values showing and kind of a bigger envelope of maybe faith, wouldn't that deliver?
I do think actually that the receding of faith does have something to do with it. As you know, there's a whole book, a chapter about religion in this book, and I have written widely about this topic. I went to see something else you mentioned. I went to see the folks at the Harvard Negotiation Project to talk to them. And Bill Ury, who wrote Getting to Yes, the defining book about negotiation, he said to me, a generation ago, or certainly two generations ago, roles were very – dad had his role. Yeah. Mom had her role. Yeah. The children had their roles. He said that's all changed. Ours is the first generation where everything has to be renegotiated.
Well,
so the truth is –
truth in that.
That's what's going on is that the gender roles have changed. Parent roles have changed. Technology – our lives are just much busier and we're always playing defense. We're not playing offense. And my chief message here is – We should be mindful about our families. If we take small steps, we can make our family happier and everybody in the family happier.
Bruce Feiler has been talking across a wide horizon of people and institutions about how to make that work. It's in his book, The Secrets of Happy Families. Ann Smith joins us in just a second from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Knows a lot about families in her own right and work. But let's get a couple callers here. Jennifer in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Thanks for calling, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi. I was calling to say that I think it's really nice to hear that there are other people out there that are practicing similar methodologies of keeping the lines of communication open, essentially, and you know, making sure that your children are heard. I don't think that they should just be treated with the you know, because I said so treatment. And I think that definitely finding out from them what is bothering them and what's causing them to act out, but then also explaining to them your views on why you feel they should, you know, behave a certain way or whatever the case is. And then also just lines of communication just in general. Like you said, just sitting around the dinner table. My husband and I have a blended family. We have four children, three of which are teenagers, 16, 12, 11, and then we also have a 7-year-old. And so we work from home, but we do travel. And but it's been a challenge in the beginning, and it does seem that the main factor that it seems to be across the board working is keeping the communication open between the siblings, and between us as step parents and as parents.
Yeah, no, that's a huge challenge. Do you buy this view, Jennifer, that you know roles have changed and we have to do some rethinking here to figure out how it can or ought to work now today?
Oh, absolutely. I think roles have changed as women and as fathers and as mothers, and now that you've got the blended family working in, and you're blending two families that have come from completely different backgrounds. You know, we both had a foundation of Christianity, so we didn't have much in the way of religion differences, but we did, you know, my children came from a family that's a very strong extended family, but their father was abusive, and then he ended up passing away. And my husband, his children came from their family, where they both worked together as more professionally, you know, as parents, and neither one of them were abusive. They both, you know, worked through things very well, but they just didn't click anymore. So
yeah, you got to pull on the threads that you've got. And make it work. You've got kids across a big range there, Jennifer, and I can see what that challenge would be like. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Judd in Bridport, Vermont. Judd, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say how vivid your intro was for me, coming home to a sink full of dishes and all that sort of stuff. I was working, and my wife has a small business in a town nearby, and when we first bought the business, I was working in heavy equipment, and I would get home at the end of the day, pick up kids, I'd be covered in grease and oil and whatever,
yeah.
And then get home, and the dogs would be crazy. The dish was, sink was full of dishes,
yes.
And dinner wasn't made.
Yes.
Lawn's not mowed. And so I was freaking out and realizing at the end of the day, after all the expenses, it was like $3 an hour coming home, and it wasn't worth $3 an hour to me to have all that stress. So I stopped working, and I'm at home with the kids. And it's certainly far from perfect, but it's a lot better than toiling away and then coming home to a complete mess.
Hey, Judd, do you have a mission statement or a clear understanding of the family, what the family values are, do you think?
I have no idea what my family values are. No, I don't know. I think we try to be communicative and we try to work through things, and we make a strong effort not to be because I said so, although there are times when that works. But I think one of the things that's helped us the most is routines where routines fit in allow for a lot more freedom. For example, my six-year-old has homework already in kindergarten, not so much for the homework's sake, but for to learn how to do it and good methodology. And having a strong routine when she gets off the bus allows that whole process to go so quickly that she and her sister have a lot more time to play in the afternoon, whereas being very relaxed didn't work for us because then it made everything take forever and it was very contentious.
At night, Judd, who's come home to make it happen, not coming home with the heavy equipment grease on his coveralls anymore, but right there to do it. Judd, good luck with that. I appreciate your call. That routine that gets certain things done so there's freedom for other things, Bruce.
The research clearly shows that all families have conflict. If you can limit and control that conflict and focus more on the positive memories, that's the direction you want to go. Spend less time worrying about what you do wrong and more time focusing on what you do right. And we back to Tolstoy, where we started this conversation. I found that there are three things that basically high-functioning families have in common. They adapt all the time. Okay, so they adjust in real time because this week it's one thing. Next week it's something else. They talk a lot. And they don't just talk about difficult conversation. As you know, Tom, there's three chapters in my book about how to talk about money and sex and, and whether you put grandma in an institution. But they talk about what it means to be part of your family. Even 10, 15 minutes a day makes a huge amount of difference. And three, they go out and play. Whatever it is you like to do, it might be hike, it might be cook, it might be sing, it might be do jigsaw puzzles. If you find time to make that positive connections when it is difficult, when you do come home and it's 6 o'clock and everybody's in chaos, if you have that positive memory, it will allow you to get through that difficult moment and move to what's positive. And by the way, just on the 6 o'clock thing, I have to say, one of the things I learned from those negotiators, highest stress time in families, 6 to 8 at night. My wife and I used to get into a fight
every
night.
Should be the best time, though. It's the only time everybody's together.
No, it's transition times that are very difficult because you're bringing the stress from your outside world. And the kids are thinking about their homework, and Dad's thinking about ordering the tickets for Thanksgiving, and Mom is thinking about sitting down and seeing how Grandma's visit to the eye doctor was. My wife and I used to fight every night at 7:42.
Oh, great.
Because we put the kids down, and then we would say, who's picking up the dry cleaning? Who's got the milk? Yeah. You know, who's got the shin guards for soccer? One of the things that we learned was we don't have difficult conversations at 7:42.
When do you do it?
We do it later. We do it earlier. Everyone's fed. But you take a simple piece of knowledge, highest stress time, move the conflict out of that stress time. Your family, you can reduce the stress.
Make some peace. Bruce Feiler's new book is The Secrets of Happy Families. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I want to bring Ann Smith in here right now from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, marriage and family therapist, author of Overcoming Perfectionism, Finding the Key to Balance and Self-Acceptance, executive director of the Breakthrough Program at Karen Treatment Centers. She blogs for Psychology Today. Ann Smith, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
What about the importance of family narrative, family story, kind of running beneath all of what we know can be chaotic in family life? Do you see that as laying a rudder down underneath a family?
I really do. And I come from a family that has done that quite well. We're Irish and we love to tell stories. So whenever something bad happens in the family, everybody says, well, that'll make a good story. And it does. And it's often told with humor. And, I've had a father particularly who has passed down the history and talks about how things were for them, my parents, who are still around at 86. And we cherish that. Extended family is so, so important. And history is what carries it.
Sorry, Ann, are children ready to hear the tough stuff too? Bruce Feiler talks about this oscillating kind of wave of fortune and misfortune that hits everybody in life.
Yes.
Are children prepared to take on board the tough stuff?
Some children more than others will be the historians who are really sponges for any stories they can get. But yes, they really do want to hear the stories. They don't feel, of course it has to be age appropriate, but they don't feel upset by those stories. They feel the courage of a family or the resilience of a family. They feel the loyalty, all those values that would be in a mission statement, even if it were not written. You know, love, support, loyalty. Surviving adventure is one of them, hard work. You know, those things came across in my family without that mission statement. And I have to say that I have pretty much the same mission statement myself with the children that I've raised and the family that I've lived in.
Bruce, I've seen that look in a children's eye. Find the right age and the right time and tell a family story. And it will really slow them down. And you can see them absorbing it in a different way. What? This is my family you're talking about? What happened with them? What might it mean to me? I've seen that. It's powerful.
What's a device do? What is a digital? What does an iPad do? I was watching my nephew today look at an iPad. It's one-on-one. Mm-hmm. What is his family story? It's one-on-many. It opens you up. Mm-hmm. Everything is not just focused on you. Mm-hmm. You are part of a long story, and you need to write the next chapter.
Bruce Feiler is with us. Ann Smith is here. Listeners, you can join us. Here's Pink with Family Portrait. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I ran away. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about family life, the real modern family, and how to make it better. One man's effort to figure it out, to find a better way. Bruce Feiler is with us. His new book is The Secrets of Happy Families. And he's gone beyond the boundaries of the normal folks you might go to ask those questions, out to the military and sports managers and businesses and Mideast negotiators to bring back what he sees as the latest of what's out there. Ann Smith is with us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, author of Overcoming Perfectionism. She's a marriage and family therapist who has seen a lot under her own roof and in her practice. A lot of perspective on what's going on. You can join us. Are you ready to write a mission statement, to put a daily duty checklist on the wall? What makes it all work at your house? What does it really take these days? Lots of feedback here. And Bruce, Kyle says, family dinners, family dance parties. I'm for that. Family bedtime stories. Of course, that is powerful and soothing at the same time. Cecilia says, treat everyone with respect. Spend time together without electronic devices around. Do things for each other. Tell them you love them often. Emily, Bruce, to your point about family goals and missions, and she says, growing up, my family had monthly family meetings where we read our family goals, negotiated chores, talked about plans for the month. It was empowering, she writes, for her as a child, to see the goals we were working toward together as a family. Among them, she still remembers, to allow each person to pursue his or her career or learning interests within the constraints of family resources. Not always abundant resources for those goals. She says, these goals hung on the wall behind the kitchen table where we ate dinner together every night. Well, there they were for dinner. And I wanted to ask you about, Bruce says, look, we're in a new era. We're old roles. Not that we, even for all the millennia we've been at it, not that we necessarily had family right anyway, but long-standing roles have changed, broken down, morphed, and we need to draw on new sources for insight into how to best make families work in this time. What do you say to that, Ann?
Well, I'm living proof of that. Families have changed. The structure of families has changed. Things change constantly. You know, people going through divorces, facing serious issues like addiction, mental illness in families.
I think you had five of your siblings' children come into your family, if I got that right.
I actually participated in raising eight children and two adult children that I consider to be my children now, too. But, yeah, I had two of my own and ended up with eight. And blended families and people dealing with tragedies that result in changes in the family structure, you have to apply these things in slightly different ways. And I'm sure there are a lot of listeners who have experienced that. No, there is no traditional framework anymore for us to go by. So I really look at things from the inside, that it is all about love. And that whatever we're doing, we need to be coming from a place of love rather than doing what we think is right, because that often falls on its face.
Bruce, does the business world look at families and say it's all about love, or is it all about spreadsheets?
Well, I don't think it's about spreadsheets. I think it's about systems to manage change. I mean, so with one of the advantages of the family meeting or 15, 20 minutes talking about how you're functioning every week is when you're fighting about getting the broccoli down on Tuesday night or arguing about on the curfew on Thursday night, you say, wait a minute, we're not going to do this now. My wife is so relieved to know we don't have to get into it at every single moment because we know we have this safe zone at the end of the week where everybody is going to talk about it. Let me address—
Even you and your wife will save some of that tough stuff for the family meeting? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, if we're talking with the kids. But even the two of us, my wife came into my office at 11 o'clock the other night.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm answering email. Yeah. She's flossing her teeth. You got the image,
yeah,
right, with the
yeah
stuff flying out of her mouth. And she says, oh, by the way, did you pay down the mortgage? And yeah, can we talk about, we need to transfer some money from the accounts.
Okay.
Tax season's coming up. And my response was, wait a minute, remember what we learned? There's a whole chapter in my book on money. And we're not going to have these conversations at 11 o'clock when everybody's exhausted. When each of us is half doing something
else. What are the mortgages due tomorrow or yesterday?
Well, we're going to sit down. Now we have quarterly meetings where we sit down and say, now we're going to talk about money. And we're going to do it at a table. In fact, we bring another voice in because as Warren Buffett's banker told me, you'll sit higher, you'll pay more attention.
With an outsider in the room, you mean?
With an outsider in the room, yes, exactly. You're going to be much more responsible.
But you can't put the mortgage off for a quarterly meeting. You'll be in arrears in 6 minutes.
I understand. But if the quarterly meeting says, okay, it's my responsibility to do the mortgage and it's your responsibility to make sure there's cash for the babysitter on Saturday night, which is the issue that we face, fine. We divvy up responsibilities. It's no longer one person deals with the money. In our house, we divide it up. But I want to go to what Ann said and to what the first caller, Tom, said, which is that the first caller was saying that she's in a blended family. In an odd kind of a way, I actually, and I want to choose my words carefully here because I'm not advocating this, but what I'm saying is blended families, divorced families, single parent families, in a way, have a little bit of an advantage because they know that when you're at mom's house, there's one set of values, and you're at dad's house, there may be a different set of values.
They see it. They experience
exactly. Therefore, mm-hmm. they have to have it out in the open. They have mm-hmm. to come out
what's
and say,
"What's it going
to
be with ours?"
Exactly. What is going to be the rules at our house? What are going to be our values? And when you are complicated, going back and forth between homes, in a way, all this stuff has to come out. So,
but isn't every family a blended family in a way? I mean, the mother and father, or whoever the parents are, they bring two different family cultures, even to, you know, just a straight up traditional marriage.
Money is a classic example. I'm actually here in Boston with my extended family for the holidays this week.
Mm-hmm.
And
Passover, Easter's coming.
Exactly. And my brother-in-law was saying the chapter on money in your book resonated because in my family, we never talked about money. 80% of kids get to college never having spoken to their parents about money, how it's made, how it's earned, debt. 80%.
80%? I do not understand. In most families, money is an issue. In most families, there's not enough of it. You can't get away with never talking about it.
But we do never talk about it, and because couples disagree. Maybe the parents disagree. Maybe one's a spendthrift. Maybe one is a saver. And the big piece of advice, as you know, I went to talk to Warren Buffett's banker who had experience, and his mm-hmm. first piece of advice was show them the money. And he said, I spoke to one of the richest women in America. She said, I can't tell my kids about money. I'll burden them. And he said, burdening them with ignorance is much worse than burdening them with truth.
Hey, Ann Smith, I want to ask you about Bruce has a kind of affinity for systems here and says, look, that's a way to get around a lot of sort of random conflict that can be repetitive and corrosive in a way. And I'm as he describes that, I can see the logic in it. And then I'm also wondering, though, is that a guy thing? What about systems in terms of organizing families for success or more than success, happiness?
Well, first I have to say that I really like his book and I really like his ideas. The thing that I can add to that is more about the emotional issues and the attachment perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think it really matters where parents are coming from. Talking about how much their own emotional history might be pushing them around. Some people will create systems like that for the wrong reasons. Many of them come from very painful families themselves and want to make sure their children never have the problems they had. Well, that's just not going to happen. No system is going to prevent the natural course that can happen to anyone. I mean, bad things can happen. So I look at more like concepts in general for people who won't necessarily do the systems. Things like people first. I know I had to do that for myself as a single parent.
People first before
and
what?
And even now.
Not before,
before
dogs.
Before anything. Before
what does it
anything.
Mean? Like
even
what?
Before dogs.
Before what,
when
though?
I walk in the house. I'm only an empty nester for a few months,
okay.
Actually. I've been parenting for 40 years.
Okay.
So the span of childcare went that long.
Yeah.
Sorry to say that to people with
people
young
ahead
children.
Of
it couldn't last that long. But people first means when you walk in the house, before you look at the mail, before you look at the mess for some of us, before you notice that the floor is filthy with dog footprints and the litter box is full, you go to the people and you look at them with love. Not obligation, but you look at them with love and you say hi. You make eye contact. You notice them. You don't – in that transition time, which Bruce is absolutely right, it's the most horrible time. Even coming back after a trip when you anticipate being happy to see each other, you're not. So people first just means touch base. That's
attachment.
I think
that acknowledgement is great, just great. Though I'm not so sure – I mean, but I kind of like some of these getting home and being together in that transition time. I mean, that can be joy too. You're back together. It's awesome.
Absolutely. It may be, but sometimes it's not. High is good.
I want to deal
more
with,
than high.
I want to deal with the resistance in your voice, Tom, because I know that some people feel it. But anybody who's in the moment, your kids are out of the house and you're in this empty nest.
Anybody for 30
in the
years.
I want to say it again because it's where we started.
Yeah.
I felt like I was always playing defense. I was reacting to what was coming in at any given moment.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife works. I work, and we felt like the reason for the systems is this idea that, wait a minute, we need to get some order. We are not making enough time for play. We are we are getting caught up in a fight that we don't want to get in. We are bickering with each other. And there is this sense that our lives are out of control, and there are ideas out there. And you can bring those ideas in. And one of the things that I did in my book, as you know, is I didn't want to say there's three or five or seven things you need to do to have a happy family. I hate those lists. I disagree with two, I forget four, and I figure I'm doomed. One of the reasons that I put 200 ideas in The Secrets of Happy Families is because it would be clear nobody could do them all. You don't need all of these systems. You pick whatever problem you've got. I almost guarantee if you pick three ideas from this book, you'll have a happier family.
But what happened to organic parenting? That's just kind of knowing these things by example from
our
own
childhoods. To the Garden of Eden. It never existed. That idyllic past. Well, yeah, it was structured because guess what? Dad worked and mom had to do all these obligations and children had to just listen. The truth is we don't live in that world. And nothing is top down anymore. Business is not top down. Government is not top down. Religion is not top down. If you want to just raise your children because I said so, that'll work for 5-8 years. And then guess what? You're not preparing your children.
Because I said so never really worked. But I take your point. Bruce Feiler's with us. Ann Smith is here. We're talking about raising families, the secrets of happy families these days. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Lillian's calling from Ledyard, Connecticut. Lillian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
We have a sort of unique situation in the wider world, but not in the military. My husband serves in the U.S. Navy on board a submarine.
Oh, boy.
And he is gone Monday through usually about half of Saturday because he lives up in Maine, where his boat is, and we decided to keep the family in Ledyard, Connecticut.
Is that how submarines work? He's literally on it for half a week and then home? I thought they went out for months at a time.
No, his boat, he's actually serving on board the USS Miami. They're up in the shipyards.
Okay.
So rather than move for a year.
Half in, half out, or half with you and half away. How's it work? How do you make it work?
Well, we are very flexible. We try very hard to be anyway. We have a 9.5-year-old daughter with Asperger's, which means that because I told you so, never, ever, ever works.
We
have a 7-year-old who's a competitive gymnast, so he does a lot of training and competitions. And we have an 18-month-old son. So I do a lot. And one thing I have learned recently in the past year where my husband has lived up in Maine is that I have to take care of myself. Because if I don't, I am not a very good mother.
Things fall apart.
I am the sole parent from Sunday evening until about noon on Saturday most weeks. But my husband and I maintain a very excellent relationship. We have a lot of communication and trust, which is something you need as a military family, absolutely. And as a whole, we run our family like submarines run. We are all equally important and we all need to rely on each other, though all of our roles are very, very different.
Everybody in the yellow submarine. Lillian, it sounds like you're making the best of what could be tough, but it sounds like you're on top of it. And do take care of yourself. That absolutely matters here. Let me get one more. Good luck to you, Lillian. Annie in Waterford, Connecticut. Annie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Our family also lives blended, if you could call it that.
Mm-hmm.
I was the daughter of Irish immigrants. My husband was the son of Italian immigrants.
Okay,
so
there's a blend.
First generation we are.
Mm-hmm. How's it working?
My husband was a policeman and I was a nurse. So outside our family structure, we dealt with the real world. But once we came home, it was our family. And I had to laugh about the phrase mission statement. Our mission statement was never dishonor your name, which came from really both sides of the family. And we managed to raise 3 children, Catholic school, braces, and all of that, with both of us working different shifts. But our time at home, those children were the most important. And we were happy. One of the things that my kids always remember were our vacations. We go from Chicago, where we lived, to the Black Hills, out to Yellowstone.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was the most fun I think my children ever had, was remembering those vacations. And we must have done something right, because our children have each taken, with their own families, that same trip.
Annie, it sounds like you've done a lot right there. Time at home with the family sacred, and you get the play part, which is very important to Bruce Feiler as well. Bruce, that go out and play, have a good time. It's not all list and mission.
It seems the easiest thing, yet it's the hardest for parents to do. You played that Rodney Atkins song earlier about remembering Grandpa, and I talked to the editor of Reunions magazine, and she was saying that most reunions begin because families gather at a funeral, and they say, you know what, let's meet at happier times, and now. Now, 200 million Americans will go to a family reunion in the next 2 years. And one of the things – I went to talk to the military. You've mentioned it a few times, so let me just talk about it. Who's better at bringing people from different worlds together than the military? They have studied it extensively for the last 50 years.
Are they going to make our family reunions go better?
It's called unit cohesion. And so the last chapter of my book, The Secrets of Happy Families, as you know, is called The Green Beret Guide to a Perfect Family Reunion. And it's about dividing people into teams, taking members from different families. Our families would get together and each family would go sit in their own corner and do their own thing. Our schedule's better than your schedule kind of thing.
Oh, jeez.
but we get people from different – in my family, we do a play. In my wife's family, we have a challenge on Cape Cod when we gather. Suddenly, we put Grandpa with grandchildren. Suddenly, he's telling a story about the old days. Nothing makes an us better than a them, so we have a little competition. Mm-hmm. And these goofy traditions are fantastic. And the goofier, the better, because – and then suddenly the next year, the grandkids are suddenly clamoring to do that Cape House challenge again or to do that play again. Adapt all the time. Talk a lot. Go out and play.
Tell the family story right through all of it. Bruce Feiler, it's been great to have you with us. The book is The Secrets of Happy Families. Good luck with those twins and the big family and the whole ball of wax, Bruce. It's great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
What a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Ann Smith in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, marriage and family therapist there, author of Overcoming Perfectionism. Sounds like it's probably a good idea. Ann, thank you so much for your time and insights today.
Well, thank you for having me.
In this hour tomorrow, we're looking at the rise and spectacular fall of Phil Spector, famous creator of the Wall of Sound. Thanks for joining us today. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio, or me, Tom Ashbrook, NPR, on Twitter. Thanks for being here. This is On Point.